World News Today, brought to you by the Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, and post-war makers of Admiral Major Home Appliances. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's Douglas Edwards.
Today in Italy, Allied troops of the Fifth Army have occupied Fondi and are battering their way forward toward the Anzio beachhead, while the Eighth Army attacks the main defenses of the Hitler line in the Liri Valley. To the northwest, Allied air power is punching new holes in Germany's invasion defenses. Moscow says the opening of the Western invasion front is imminent, and that the Germans know the Allies can break any defenses they set up. In the Far East, the North Burma campaign is approaching a climax, with Allied troops in possession of a third of the Jap base of Michinar. And General Stilwell reports that American liberators have attacked a Jap island within 300 miles of the Philippines. And now for the story of today's operations on the Italian front, Admiral takes you to CBS Naples, Farnsworth Fowle reporting.
It has just been officially released that Fifth Army troops have reached Fondi, 7 miles beyond Itri on the Appian Way. This puts the Fifth Army at one end of yet another lateral road running north from the Appian Way to Highway 6. These roads are like city blocks in measuring the advance. The first such block was the Ausonia Road. Next came the road from Itri north to Pico. First, the artillery interdicted the highway, then light French troops straddled it south of Pico, then the Americans coming up the Appian Way cut off and captured Itri itself. Yesterday, the French were meeting a good deal of opposition in Pico. Nothing has been heard from that sector today. The campaign is at one of those stages where forward elements are much more intent on pushing on to the next town than reporting back to headquarters what they've already accomplished. So if the news is delayed, it isn't always the fault of headquarters. The Germans have been driven from most of the original Hitler line positions. Their game from now on will probably be to cover their retreat as long as possible, and then pull back to the next good natural defensive position. This sort of thing went on for several weeks in Sicily last summer, after the Allied armies got the upper hand. Unless the Germans bring in a lot of reinforcements, the 5th and 8th armies now definitely have the upper hand in central Italy. The fighter bombers of the tactical air force supporting the armies are having a field day. When the Germans were dug in during the last few months, the planes got few live targets to bomb and strafe. Nowadays, the Germans are compelled to use the roads, and trucks and moving artillery are frequently caught in daylight. Since the attack began, the air forces claim more than 200 vehicles in flame. They grumble when clouds and rain reduce their activity and let the Germans move unmolested. The weather over the front this morning was good enough to cheer them up again. Another cheering sight for the ground troops is the regular appearance of formations of heavy bombers on their way north. For a long time, the big fellows were painted olive drab. Those that were based in the desert were a sort of sandy pink. The idea was to make them inconspicuous on the ground or in the sky. Nowadays, we're seeing more and more B-24s wearing the old pre-war silver paint. This lightweight, smooth surface adds several miles an hour to their speed. The same goes for the new P-51 Mustang fighters. German air opposition is so limited nowadays that speed in the air is more important than disguising their whereabouts on the ground. If anyone thinks that these splendid advances have been easy and that progress has been a triumphal march, he'd better wait for the casualty reports. It was only after 3 days of the bitterest back-and-forth fighting that the American forces on the coast were able to get rolling. All you have to do is compare the expressions on the faces of the infantry. A company going in to attack Santa Maria last week were wisecracking and grinning. A few days later, they'd taken on the sober, preoccupied look of men who know what hard fighting is, and who know that they're in for a lot more of it. I return you now to New York.
More news in just a moment. But first, here is Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation.
Admiral radios have long been acclaimed for their beautiful design and excellent styling. This is one of the important reasons why America has come to prefer Admiral and why Admiral is the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. In order to zealously guard this reputation for breathtaking eye appeal, Admiral Corporation has retained one of the world's foremost designers to style the new peacetime models of Admiral radios, refrigerators, electric ranges, and home freezers. This internationally famous industrial designer is George W. Walker, whose achievements cover the design for more than 2,000 products now in everyday use, including automobiles and many home appliances. For the past 2 years, Mr. Walker has been head of the Industrial Designing Division of the United States Ordnance Department in Washington. Admiral Corporation feels very fortunate to have the services of such a distinguished designer, whose knowledge and skill will reflect themselves in your after-the-war Admiral radios and household appliances. Now, here again is Douglas Edwards.
An American newspaper woman recently did a little traveling on her own in France. She got as far as Paris. She's back in Portugal now, and for her story, Admiral takes you to CBS Lisbon, Alice Leon Motes reporting. Regret that we are not able at the moment to make contact with our correspondent in Portugal. But now, for a summary of developments in the Central Pacific, Admiral takes you after a brief pause to CBS Pearl Harbor, Webley Edwards reporting.
Admiral Nimitz has announced that Army and Navy planes attacked airfields and shipping in the Kuriles north of Japan, and Army, Navy, and Marine planes attacked the bypassed Marshall Islands. These strikes round out a week of consistent bombing all along the wide Pacific front, in which the Kuriles were hit 3 times, Wake twice, the Marshalls every day for 7, and the Caroline 7. Nevertheless, this came close to being the quietest week the Pacific Fleet, its auxiliary shore-based planes, and its amphibious forces have passed in quite a long time. Highlighting the week in the greater Pacific theater were the capture of Wadki Island off Hollandia on New Guinea by MacArthur's forces and a strike by carrier task forces at Surabaya on Java. This attack, the first to hit Java by seaborne planes, was reportedly also the first to bring together the carrier forces from the three great Pacific Ocean Allied commands, from Nimitz Pacific Fleet and Ocean Areas Command, from MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Command, and from Mountbatten's command beyond the Malay Peninsula. This merging of forces against the Jap is not new. Not quite a month ago, Admiral Nimitz sent strong carrier task force groups of the Pacific Fleet to the North New Guinea coast to support the invasion of Hollandia by General MacArthur's men. In fact, interlocking organization is now a keynote of the United States' advance in the Pacific. This is not only true of the three great commands. Merging of Commander-in-Chief Pacific Ocean Areas Army and Navy forces under Nimitz, an accomplished fact for some time, was formally announced at Fleet Headquarters this week. Almost a year ago, Admiral Nimitz foresaw the need for a joint staff, and this is now a fact. Visitors to his headquarters, expecting an all-Navy show out here, are surprised at the great number of Army uniforms. Army, Navy, and Marine staff officers live together in the same general quarters, eat together, and fight the war together. This week, the joint staff of the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet and Pacific Ocean Areas was announced. In charge of J-1, or plans, is a Rear Admiral, Forrest Sherman. In charge of J-2, intelligence, is an Army Brigadier General, Joe Twitty. In command of J-3, operations, is Navy Captain H.L. Collins. And commanding J-4, supplies, an Army man, Major General E.H. Levy. Thus, two of the first four heading up the Pacific Ocean Area joint staff are Army men. Two Navy officers round out the staff, Navy Captain R.C. Parker, Analysis, and Navy Captain P.V. Mercer, Administration. An example of the unity of all branches out here is the fact that all shore-based air forces in the Central Pacific area, consisting of Army, Navy, and Marine air outfits, are commanded by an Army Major General, Willis Hale. Along with the rest of America, there's a great deal of interest out here in the Italian campaign and the impending European invasion. This has been a fairly quiet week in the Pacific. Invasion or not, There's no reason to believe that the Pacific theater of war is bound to remain quiet. There's been for some months now a great deal of planning and getting ready all through the Pacific area to strike ever harder at the Jap. This is Webley Edwards at Pearl Harbor, returning you to Admiral Radio in New York.
Back in this country, after a tour of the Italian fronts and Iran, is a former CBS employee who is now a major in the Army Service Forces. For his story, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
Here's a man who has just come back from the Italian front and a visit to the Persian Gulf in Iran, where American men and machines are moving supplies to the Russians. He's Major Luther Reed of the Army Service Forces, and he has a story to tell about the supplies and care your boys are getting at the front. Let's start in Italy, Major. How about the supply job there?
Well, I left there about 2 weeks ago, and the situation has changed somewhat since then. But I can tell you something about the job those boys had before they could even get ready for this offensive. And that was a supply job almost entirely. They were fighting in the mountains all through the winter in the worst kind of weather. Everything an army needs had to be taken up there every day. It started out in trucks until the going got too rough. Then it was transferred to jeeps, and then to mules, and finally to the backs of men. Even mules couldn't climb over some of those trails, so each man would strap a 5-gallon can of water, or a box of rations, or a load of ammunition on his back and haul it up to the infantry line.
And the infantry, I guess, just stayed up there.
Yes, they just stayed up there and fought. Their foxholes were full of mud, their clothes were soaking wet, and there was never a chance to get dried out.
Well, how did they get wounded out of a place like that?
That was a major operation. They had to be carried down the mountain trails by relays of litter bearers. Sometimes it took as much as 27 hours to get a man down far enough to put him in a jeep. And it took as many as 70 or 80 men working along that relay trail through snow and mud to take one man out. But they worked their hearts out to do it, and the losses were unbelievably low. They had blood plasma stations along the way, and then, if they needed it, the men were given transfusions of whole blood as soon as they got to the hospital. And that blood was given by the GIs, who were always ready to volunteer.
Major, what kind of food do the boys get in a place like that?
They're getting good food, nutritious food, and plenty of it. And the further forward you go toward the front lines, the better the food is, because the choicest goes to the men up front. Of course, the infantry patrols, up where they can't have kitchens, have to eat cold food from tin cans until they can get back far enough to have the steaks and other fresh foods that are sent forward. But there's nothing that anyone can do about that, of course.
Well, I suppose the supply job up there will be a lot easier now that we've pushed through the mountains.
Not easier, perhaps, but certainly it will be a different problem. The Germans will wreck every bridge on the road to Rome and tear up the roadbed, too. Our engineers will have to go out in front and rebuild every foot of it under fire before the troops can move ahead.
Well, just briefly now, what did you find in the Near East, Major?
Well, I found a bunch of American officers and men who used to work on American railroads here at home have performed a miracle. They've transformed the toy railroad of the old Shah of Persia into one of the busiest railroads in the world, and certainly one of the world's most important supply routes.
Did you make a trip on that road?
Yes, sir, on the cowcatcher of a diesel locomotive, hauling a whole trainload of American tanks, guns, food, and other supplies to the Russian army. Incidentally, that railroad in the desert goes through the hottest recorded spot on the face of the earth. But the Russians themselves say that the stuff we have sent to them over this railroad has been a vital factor in their offensive that is driving the Germans out of Russia.
I return you now to Admiral in New York.
American bombers from Britain continue to attack the French coast. For details and an interview with an RAF flyer who participated in the recent attack on Norway, Admiral takes you to CBS London, Charles Collingwood reporting.
American bombers have been out today, in spite of uncertain weather in the Straits of Dover, attacking targets in France and Germany. The RAF were over northwest Germany last night, taking care of their end of the Allied air offensive. This cooperation between the RAF and the American Air Force is much more than a matter of simply picking out targets for one or the other to destroy. It's much deeper and has gone on much longer than that. There are, for instance, a surprising number of Americans who are in the United States Army and wear American uniform who are serving with the RAF. One of them is here with me tonight. He's Lieutenant Edward Ernst. On his United States Army uniform, he wears the American wings on his left breast and the RCAF wings on his right. I suppose you were in the RAF for some time before you transferred to the United States Army, weren't you, Lieutenant Ernst?
That's right. I went up to Canada and joined up about 3 years ago.
Well, that was before we were in the war, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And when did you get over here to England?
Well, I'm in Corporal Command, you see. And I went through a lot of training in Canada, and then I was sent over here about a year ago.
Well, how do you like serving with the RAF?
As long as they keep me there, it's all right with me. Talk about leased land. You get paid by one country and you fly for another.
I guess the cooperation between the American and British air forces is pretty good, isn't it?
As far as I can see, you might as well call it an allied air force. I was with Air Sea Rescue for a while, and we never drew any distinction between the American or British flyers we got out of the sea. I think that was the best job I had. Every time you get some of those guys out, you feel as if you accomplished something.
Are you still in Air Sea Rescue?
No, I fly bullfighters now.
By the way, Lieutenant Ernst, I haven't asked you this, but you're walking around with a cane and with one foot all bandaged up. How did that happen?
Well, I got shot up.
Well, how did it happen?
Well, we were escorting some torpedo bombers on a strike in the North Sea, and, well, I got hit.
Well, how did it happen?
Well, I don't really know. We went out there, and there were some German fighters, and they hit us. And the next thing I knew, I was in the hospital.
Oh, come on now, Ernst. I know that you flew all the way back to England, and that when you landed, they found 240 bullet holes in your plane.
I know. That's what they told me. But, you know, you do a lot of these things by instinct.
Lieutenant Ernst, I think you must have picked up in the RAF this British habit of understatement. Anyway, how's your foot coming along?
Oh, it's all right. When I get this plaster off, I think maybe I can get a shoe on it.
Oh, that's fine. By the way, I didn't ask you where you came from, Lieutenant Ernst.
I'm a California boy.
Hands across the sea, eh?
I've got all these English Kenya fellows moving out to California when the war is over.
Well, that's the way it ought to be, all right. What do you think of this Anglo-American business, Lieutenant?
Well, I think this Anglo-American business is really important. I'm sort of a go-between. I know both sides. When one of these American kids sounds off about the British, I climb all over him. Then I get back to the station and have to bawl out an RAF guy because he's got us Americans wrong.
Well, I think you're doing a fine job, Lieutenant Ernst, and I hope you get all those fellows to go back and live in California. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
The Army needs more what? Needs them for the obvious reason that they release men for fighting and also because it's found they do a very good job indeed. Admiral has asked a typical WAC to talk over her job with CBS reporter Bill Slocum, Jr.
There's an iron-bound tradition in this business of radio reporting. When you're interviewing a gal, you must first weep quietly because television has not yet arrived, so all you listeners could see what the interviewer is seeing. I'm going to skip that because if television was here now, you would be seeing a very pretty young lady. But I and most of my unbeautiful contemporaries would be out of work. Having thus interviewed myself briefly, let's meet our guest for today. LaVon Widnes is her name. She's a sergeant in the WAC attached to Mitchell Field out on Long Island. Sarge, what's your job at Mitchell Field?
I'm a radio operator, Mr. Slocum. I work in the Army Airways Communication System.
That means you talk back and forth to planes in transit in this area.
That's right. We give pilots weather information and instructions, and they tell us their estimated time of arrival, if any VIPs are aboard or not.
VIPs?
Very important people.
Oh, you mean brass hats.
No, you may mean brass hats, but I'm in the Army, so they're very important people.
How do these gay young pilots react to hearing a feminine voice giving them their position or other information?
Well, they can't vary from regular Air Corps procedure in their questions and answers, but they do sometimes sort of sweeten their voices up a bit. You really haven't heard anything yet until you hear some second lieutenant giving his estimated time of arrival like Charles Boyle.
Sergeant, how long have you been a WAC?
About 18 months.
I know this is a fighting question to any WAC, but why did you join the WAC?
I wanted to do something about this thing, this war.
Yes.
And I wanted to travel. And incidentally, the money isn't bad at all. I had a job at home in St. Paul, but it got a little dull. There's nothing dull about the WAC.
Have you done much traveling?
Let's see. I've been stationed at Des Moines, Kansas City, Fort Oglethorpe, Detroit, New York City, and now Long Island. That's pretty good traveling for a country gal.
I know you monitor three frequencies, two on the Morse code, one in straight voice. It sounds complicated.
It's not really. They never ask you to do anything in the WAC until they've taught you how to do it.
Tell me, Sergeant Witness, are you and your mates intrigued by the new WAC uniforms?
Indeed we are. We're women, you know.
Yes, so I've noticed. Would you describe those new uniforms?
They are one piece, shantung, and very simple and very well tailored. They are light beige or creamy tan, and they look very expensive. And the new hats are quite an improvement.
Every WAC I ever talked with was delighted to be in the Corps. Why?
Well, you do interesting work, and you do it with very nice people. I find it very easy to save money, and I certainly have seen a lot of this country. But I think the most important thing to all of us is simply this. We have a wonderful feeling of accomplishing something, of doing our share, of carrying our share of the burden.
Well said, Sergeant LaVon Widnes. Thanks. Now back to Douglas Edwards.
For an analysis of the military situation on the Burma front, here is Major George Fielding Elliott.
The Japanese forces all around the frontiers of Burma are being broken up into small, isolated groups and appear to face destruction or disintegration. On the North Burma front, the Japanese in Mishanao, Mogong, and Kamang are now cut off from each other and from any hope of reinforcement or retreat, except that the Mishanao force does still have open the motor road to Bamo, which is constantly being harassed by Allied patrols and aircraft. The fall of Mishanao itself appears imminent, whereafter General Stilwell will be able to turn the concentrated attention of his forces to the extinction of the Japanese main force in Kamang, which is believed to include the bulk of the 18th Japanese Division and part of another division. On the northwest Burma front, the British Indian troops have now succeeded in throwing a roadblock across the main supply route of the Japanese forces in the vicinity of Imphal, that is, the Imphal-Tidim Road. Another roadblock south of Kohima isolates the Japanese who are still in the hills east of that town. The British are still holding their roadblock on the Palel-Tamu Road farther south. Thus, the Japanese on this front, too, are broken up into groups. And though they can still retreat over the hills toward the Chinvin River, the chances of a successful withdrawal by these routes is menaced by the approaching monsoon, while the Allied forces still have the inestimable benefit of air transport and supply. Of this, the movement of the 5th Indian Division by air from the Arakan front to the Kohima area in a matter of hours is a striking example. At least 10 days, and probably more, would have been required to execute this move by road and rail by way of Chittagong. In addition to these troubles, the Japanese face the threat of the Chinese offensive drive westward across the Salween River, directed on Bamo and Lashio. It is not too much to say that chances now favor the full collapse of the Japanese power in all Upper Burma, north of Mandalay, within a period of days or at least weeks.
That was Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott. And now, once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Corporation.
There have been many promises made when victory comes for labor-saving devices to make for easier and more abundant living. But nothing will offer more real enjoyment than the ownership of an Admiral home freezer. You'll forget about seasons. You'll be able to keep all the fresh food you wish on hand, winter or summer. You can buy several months' supply at once without the slightest danger of spoilage. You can enjoy delicacies rarely found in your part of the country and have them whenever you want them. You can order or prepare frozen desserts weeks before you need them, or prepare whole dinner parties days in advance. You'll save hours of work and miles of travel to and from market. Yes, the Admiral Home Freezer will indeed be the magic key to better living for you and your family, and your savings on food costs will soon pay for it. The name it will bear, Admiral, will be your assurance of its high quality, for it will be designed and built by those same fine technicians who have produced Admiral Radio, known to everyone as America's Smart Set. The farm labor shortage is even more serious than it was in 1943. Despite this, the need for American food is so great that American farmers have been asked to surpass last year's record-breaking yields. To meet this goal, farmers will need the help of 4 million extra workers at the peak of the harvest season. Most of these must come from non-farm people, men and women, boys and girls, who will volunteer for part-time work on a farm. Prevailing wages will be paid to volunteers. Plan now to help American farmers in this time of crisis. Remember, food fights for freedom. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, and post-war makers of Admiral Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezer Lockers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.
Accuracy as the Bulova Lady Springfield. Infinitely smart, 14-carat pink gold, richly set with diamond and rubies. Has 17-jewel Bulova movement. See it now.